Hi, it's Robin Young. Thank you for listening to Here and Now. If you love to listen to your favorite shows, hear your favorite stories, and NPR is your personal connection to the world, keep your love for public radio alive. Visit donate.npr.org/now to give, and then tell the world why you're passionate about listening by tweeting or posting on Facebook with hashtag WhyPublicRadio.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd, in for Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. House lawmakers have given final passage to the largest tax cuts in three decades after a revote this afternoon to make it comply with the Senate plan passed overnight. House Speaker Paul Ryan presided.
On this vote, the yeas are 224 and the nays are 201. The motion is adopted. Without objection, the motion to reconsider is laid upon the table.
The plan makes large corporate tax cuts permanent and smaller individual tax cuts temporary. Let's get right to our political strategist, John Brabender, Republican strategist. Hi, John.
How are you doing today?
Doing well. And Jamal Simmons, a Democratic strategist. Hi, Jamal.
Hello. How are you?
I'm doing well. And let me just start with each of you asking, what do you think the significance of this moment is? John, start with you.
Well, I would say two things. First of all, as a media consultant, I now have something for clients of mine to run on next year. We're going to be able to tell 80% of American taxpayers that they got a tax cut. We can tell American workers that the companies they work for are now going to be more competitive internationally because of corporate tax cuts. And we've already seen that the stock market likes this, and a significant number of people, middle class, have investments in the stock market, so they're already benefiting. I think the second big thing we have to understand, though, the Republicans got this done and now understand the formula, is that the Democrats are not going to work across the aisle, so we've got to figure out a way to get things done on our own.
Jamal?
Well, I think the biggest problem here is that Americans are going to realize that they're not going to get as much out of this as they thought. It's amazing to me that Republicans who have started to lose all these races, they lost in Virginia, lost in Alabama, and now their answer to try to win Americans back is to give a tax cut that benefits people who make over $400,000, $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 in tax cuts. And for people who make less than $75,000, they're going to get hundreds of dollars of tax cuts, maybe $900 of tax cuts. That means, you know what $900 is? It's $35 every 2 weeks. It's about a tank of gas. If you think you're going to rebuild the Republican brand off of giving Americans a tank of gas every 2 weeks, I'm happy to have that debate.
But Jamal, Paul Ryan and other Republicans have been making this point over and over again in the past couple of days that Americans are going to learn to love this tax bill when they start to see that money that you're talking about in their paychecks come tax time. It actually might make a difference to a lot of people, they're saying. You sounds like you don't buy that argument.
Yeah, because what I'm saying is for a tank of gas every 2 weeks, you're going to have to get $1 trillion in deficits that we're going to borrow from the Chinese. We're going to endanger the fact we may have to go after Medicare and cut Medicare costs for people. And we're going to cut back on the Obamacare health mandate so their health care costs may end up going up. I don't think you can trade a tank of gas every 2 weeks for that kind of fault line on the other side.
John?
Well, look, I think, first of all, it's amazing how this has shifted, that now the Democrats are arguing, oh, you're getting a tax cut, but it's really not as big a tax cut as you might have thought it was. Well, they voted against it. So they voted against any tax cut. That's number one. Second of all, there's going to be a lot of debates on the numbers. I've seen numbers that said that the average household who makes about $75,000 a year is going to see a tax break of about $2,000 every year. Plus, there was the doubling of the per-child tax credit. And so, I think this is a great balance. I also think that it is going to make America much more secure financially, in the sense that we're going to have the stability of being able to compete internationally. So if you're a blue-collar worker at a manufacturing plant, your job also just got more secure, and I think that's a pretty good thing.
Oh, that's not actually true. That's not actually true, because here's the thing. All these corporate executives who are going to get these big tax cuts, and that money for the corporations, which is a permanent tax cut, while the money for individuals is a temporary tax cut, that corporate money is going to then go to shareholders and executives in bonuses. There is no indication whatsoever that that money is going to go into either wages or into more investment, unless a company has overtly said it. Like, a few companies have said they would do it. Most of the companies refuse to make that kind of
commitment. Yeah, a lot of companies have said that they will will give this back to shareholders and not raise wages for their workers. I want to ask about what this means for President Trump. Here he is this afternoon at a cabinet meeting talking about the tax cut plan.
A lot of reform in there, but the tax cuts supersede. And I said very specifically, use the word tax cuts. You know, for 34 years, they've been trying to do this, and they haven't. And they use the word reform. Well, there is reform, but I said we're going to be talking about tax cuts.
But as Jamal points out and as others point out, this does really help the wealthy, and the effects on the middle class remain to be seen. What does this do to Trump's populist brand that he ran on, John?
Well, first of all, I can't let that go just as a statement of fact. A lot of people would disagree with you and say this is helping. In fact, if you look at the percentages, the upper income are now going to pay a larger percentage of the entire tax burden on Americans, and the middle class are going to pay a lower burden. So, number one, that's not necessarily true. Second of all, we get into this where we talk about corporate tax cuts, and everybody wants to think about the Ford Motor Company or these companies with thousands and thousands of employees. I have 30 employees. My company is a corporation. There are a lot of small businesses. In fact, the majority of businesses in this country are small businesses. They're incorporated. And it's going to help those small businesses in this country as well. And then third of all, I don't know how you can look at anything but this being a win for the president. I think it was a much needed win. I think that both the House and the Senate pulled everything together. And I think there's a lesson here also for Donald Trump. He did this by working cautiously and in a spirit of cooperation rather than through intimidation like was tried in the health care bill. And I think that approach worked much better and was one of the reasons we have success today.
Right. The outcome of this debate is so much different than the attempts to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Jamal, are Democrats worried that the president has figured this out and he might have learned something as he tries to get other big ticket items through Congress, whether that be an infrastructure plan, immigration reform, building the wall, that sort of thing?
Democrats have been worried since last November of 2016 when Donald Trump surprised the world and got elected
president.
But he
wasn't able to do anything before.
He wasn't able to do anything, and I think but that's the reason why you're seeing people show up in places like Virginia, where we overran, overran those elections. People show up in like Alabama. You're seeing even in Georgia, where John Ossoff lost, you saw that gap narrow down to a 3 or 4% gap. Democrats are worried, and they're going to turn out and vote. The problem is, what kind of damage will the Republicans do to the Republic of this, to the United States, over the course of time while they're in charge? And what we're seeing is they are willing to throw us into debt to the Chinese by another $1 trillion. We're seeing they're willing to put Medicare in jeopardy. And now they're going to perhaps be willing to do a bunch of other things that are going to really hurt the economy in the meantime.
I got a question, though. All of a sudden, we have these new deficit hawks on the Democrat side, the same Democrats who
Like Bill Clinton, who helped cut the deficit and got a surplus?
Under President Obama, the Democrats raised the deficit by $10 trillion. So now, all of a sudden, they're critics of tax cuts because they're not big enough. They're critics of the deficit going up. What this president and this Congress did on the Republican side is they bet on America. They bet that by making competition more available for our corporations, by putting more dollars in the households of hardworking families, that we'll see the economy take off even greater than it is. And right now, this is a pretty darn good economy.
Well, let's just be sure we get the history right. Bill Clinton got us to a place where we had surpluses in the budget. George Bush is the one who did tax cuts and went to war without paying for it that made us have deficit spending. And then when Barack Obama took office, we had the biggest recession we'd ever seen. And so he was trying to borrow money in order to get us out of that hole. Now we have a pretty good economy. We got to increase wages. But the Republicans are willing to take food off of our shelves that we're going to need for a rainy day and spend it today when we don't actually need to do it. And they're not even going to guarantee that wages are going to get increased.
Okay.
This is a problem.
Let me just get to one more thing in the minute or so we have left. I want to understand what happened with Jeff Flake and Bob Corker, both of whom are not running again and do not like President Trump and decided to vote for this bill. Now, here's Bob Corker on CNN yesterday. He was asked about what's being called the Corker kickback, whether he changed his vote from a no to a yes on the final plan because of the addition of a provision that would benefit real estate company owners like himself.
I know people are having a good time with this, but it's just malicious. I'm making this decision because I believe that it is best for the country, period.
John, help me understand, why do you think Corker and Flake voted for this?
Yeah, I saw Corker say this, that he looked at the entirety of the bill, and he wasn't happy with everything. But when you look at the significant tax cuts going to working families and to help make America more competitive, that he felt that that was the driving force of why he had to support this, even though he is still concerned about how it will raise the deficit.
But he had nothing to lose.
Well, other than his credibility and his honor, and we've seen from Bob Corker, is this is somebody who's not afraid to go his own way. He has, particularly in recent months. And so for him to also come on board, I think it shows that there is universal agreement that this is something that's good for America and good for working families.
It's just amazing that that thing that's good for America is a big cutout for real estate investors like Bob Corker. And number two, that we know all these Republican donors were saying this is something that had to happen. I think that's the place to look at the Republican donors who told all these Republicans, be for this or you're going
to
pay a price.
Right. I mean, it does seem like a question that is at least fair to pose to the senator. Jamal Simmons, a Democratic strategist, and John Brabender, a Republican strategist. Thanks to you
both.
Thanks,
guys.
Thank you, guys.
Russian world chess champion and political activist Garry Kasparov is warning Americans not to let President Trump turn the U.S. into Russia, which Kasparov sees as profoundly undemocratic under President Putin. He laid out his argument this week in a series of tweets, which you can find at hereandnow.org. But Garry Kasparov joins us now. Welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
And what do you mean Americans shouldn't let Trump turn the U.S. into Russia?
It's a warning. It's, of course, a long shot. But I think many people today, they are really concerned about the direction of this great country is taking. And I think that when we go back 2 years, very few could have imagined that we'll be dealing with the problems generated in the White House that are threatening the very foundation of this republic.
What problems are you talking about?
I think we should look at Trump's criticism not against individuals, that's a bad taste, but against institutions. And that's the playbook of every would-be dictator. And Trump is very consistent in his attacks against U.S. institutions, U.S. electoral system, free press, now law enforcement. And it's worrisome because that's what every dictator did, starting his campaign on destroying the pillars of democracy.
But isn't there a difference between saying fake news or going after specific news outlets and, for example, killing journalists, jailing journalists, or jailing political opponents?
Oh, that's why, you know, I say it's still a long way to go, and I don't think we'll ever see the same problems here as we're seeing in Russia or in other authoritarian and totalitarian countries. But you'd better be aware that such dangers do exist. And the fact is that within a year, probably we can say more than a year, adding up the time Donald Trump has spent in his campaign going after U.S. institutions. He did a very good job by swaying a big chunk of Americans, 25-30%, with him to believe that there's a deep state and institutions that are not doing the good job. And I think the fact is that many people are just losing their faith in FBI, in other law enforcement offices, in the free press. They buy the concept of fake news and deep state. That's a big success for Vladimir Putin because all Putin wanted to discredit democracy as an institution. And the fact is that now American democracy in it's not in jeopardy, but it's in kind of in a gray area. So where people have doubts about the way these institutions are functioning, that's troubling for me.
What do you think are the key differences between Trump and Putin?
No, Trump is still the president of the United States. It's a democracy. He was elected, whether we, you know, just like him or not. He was elected by the law of the land. Vladimir Putin's election was a charade from day one. It was all known in advance. And so that's why when Vladimir Putin now is heading for a new election campaign, it's rather a reappointment than a re-election. But no doubt the Trump envies Putin and other authoritarian leaders and dictators in the world, because Trump definitely wants to have the same uncontrolled power. And Vladimir Putin, as an experienced KGB agent, knows how to play with the weaknesses of his counterparts.
You mentioned Putin now heading for an almost assured fourth term. He just officially kicked off his campaign yesterday. Do you think, even though the Constitution forbids him from running again in 2024, that he's going to try in some way to stay in power after that?
Look, there's very strong arguments that he was not allowed to run even the third time, because Russian Constitution is quite explicit talking about two terms, but they just played with words and brought him back. Dictators never walk away because of constitutional restrictions. If he survives until 2024, because, again, dictators, they don't know how their rule ends, since they could be very popular on Sunday, and then on Monday something terrible happens to them. But even if he survives, the Constitution will not be the reason of his demise, because they will always find a way of going around it, changing it, and coming up with new concepts of the governance. And there will be always so-called people's enthusiasm and public demand for a strong leader not to depart prematurely, even if he stays in power for 25 years.
I want to listen to a piece of tape. This is in an interview with CNN's Jim Sciutto this week. This is the former director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, praising Putin's canniness, saying Putin's thank you call to President Trump on Sunday for sharing intelligence about a potential bombing in Russia was great casework by a former KGB agent. Here he is.
He knows how to handle an asset, and that's what he's doing with the president.
You're saying that Russia is handling President Trump as an asset?
That's the appearance to me.
What do you think about that? And this is something that has come up before, how much President Trump may be being manipulated by Putin.
Oh, I couldn't agree more with this assessment. I don't believe for a minute that there was a CIA tip about this would-be terrorist attack in Russia. All we know about the terrorist attacks in Russia over the last 20 years, either KGB was directly involved or somehow preferred to ignore it and just to let terrorists to carry their heinous intentions. The problem, we cannot verify or refute it, and that's what Putin wanted to achieve by giving Trump Trump card to undermine Russian investigation. I will not be surprised if that's a part of the plot to fire Mueller, just creating a smokescreen and offering Putin an excuse by being exonerated, since we could see such fruitful cooperation between CIA and KGB.
But when you look at that dynamic between Putin and Trump, you can see what Putin would be getting out of that situation. What is Trump getting out of that situation of praising Vladimir Putin over and over again?
Trump has been also praising Erdogan and Xi Jinping, but obviously his relations with Putin is quite unique. And I think that's what the Mueller investigation has to find out, because what I can tell you by just following the news on Russian TV, that while anti-American propaganda hasn't stopped, it's 24/7 America's bashing, Russian TV has never criticized Donald Trump. And it's all controlled by Vladimir Putin. And the only criticism for Trump you can hear there, it's just Trump being too weak to control the deep state. There are some evil force in the United States that are preventing president who is willing to improve relations with Russia from doing it.
Garry Kasparov, as a chess master, do you see this dynamic in a different way than the rest of us do? Are you watching all of this as if it were a chess game?
No, I have to say that it's, from my perspective, 2017 was not a bad year, because many Americans realized how dangerous the situation, how fragile the situation was. But it's we're just in the beginning, or maybe I would say in the middle game, if I use chess terminology, because recognizing the threat is it's a first step, but you have to come up with a strategy. And it seems to me that strategy is not there, and it's just the beginning of the debate about the strategy. And that's the way to deal with dictators, because if you try to play a sharp tactical game, it's a very short-term game, with a dictator you will lose, since dictator is not limited in his actions by public opinion, parliamentary investigations, free press. The only way to counter this kind of activities, clandestine operations against you run by dictatorships, is to come up with a strategy. It's a long view. to guarantee that the advantages of democracy will eventually prevail. But that means we need politicians, rather not politicians, but statesmen who will look beyond their term in the office. And so far, I see very little of this in this country or in Europe.
You made some comments about chess recently. You said that you now think that a woman could be a world chess championship. You didn't think that before. What changed?
Look, things are just changing in everywhere. So, and obviously, the gap between female and male players is not as great as it was 30 years ago. You know, it's still there. So there's, I think, only one female player, the strongest one, who you find from China. She's making top 100. But we had also an example of great Judith Polgár, the Hungarian player. She was at one point top 10. So that's why there's nothing precludes female players of climbing higher. It may take longer than people want, but the trend is inevitable. And as everywhere else, you know, we could see more and more female players competing on equal terms with their male competitors.
But did something change for you about your view of that, or is it just there are more better female players now?
I'm just analyzing the facts. So I'm simply referring to the statistics, and the statistics now is telling that the balance of power has been changing.
You're doing an online chess course as of this week through masterclass.com. What do you want to teach people who sign up?
It's not just teaching. It's more like sharing my passion and love for the game of chess, because even in 7 hours, you cannot teach people how to play chess. It's not about giving information. It's about insight and inspiration. Those are the most important things a teacher can provide a student. And I prepare this curriculum, and of course it includes tactics and strategy and many useful advices. But at the end of the day, it's for students to get more excited about it and to see the beauty of the game. That's just to enjoy these moments where they could solve the study and just to be so proud about their ability to move one step further in their understanding of this great game.
That's Garry Kasparov, chess champion, Russian pro-democracy activist, author, and more. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
A European Union court has ruled that Uber should be regulated like a taxi cab company. The European Court of Justice ruled on a case brought by taxi drivers in Barcelona, but the ruling will impact the entire EU, including the United Kingdom. Joining us with more is Robin Farzad, host of Full Disclosure on NPR One. Hi, Robin.
Hi again, Jeremy.
And first, just explain a little more about this case. Why did the taxi drivers in Barcelona want Uber to be considered a transportation company?
Well, como se dice en español, because Uber drank their milkshake.
Right.
No cab driver in history has enjoyed the vaporization of his income. And you know, Uber has kind of done this the world over in just a few short years. It's now in 600 plus cities.
And what does this mean for Uber, this ruling from the European Court of Justice?
Well, coming out of the gate under its founder, Travis Kalanick, who was pretty much ousted this year for pushing too far, too fast, too aggressively, and stepping on too many toes, this means that it's going to have to step back and reconsider its old motif of, you know, under him it was ask for forgiveness instead of permission. Now Uber has to comply with individual EU state transport regulations, and it has to become more of a diplomat. It can't just say that we are under an EU-wide tech standard, and that's going to slow down its rollout as it's really looking to IPO this massive company.
It's interesting that Uber was ever able to get away with saying that they weren't a transportation company in Europe, but that's what they basically were able to do.
Look, it cuts both ways. I mean, if you're Uber, you're saying that we are torchbearers for the gig economy. Everybody is a free agent. We're giving you freedom. There's all this spare capacity. You can make money on the depreciation of your car. We are friends without benefits, if you will. And others out there, unions and cab drivers, are saying, nah. It took me years to work to, you know, an indentured servitude to pay to get this medallion. Once I have this medallion, you guys show up out of nowhere with no benefit restrictions, no paperwork restrictions. It should be an apples to apples competition here. You're a cab company, even if they are at will employees. And from their perspective, if you lard up enough regulations and fees and surcharges, it's going to equalize the price between Uber and the cab services. And a lot of these Uber drivers will go away.
Well, could this significantly hurt Uber's business in Europe?
Already, it's in the big cities, and I think by the time it's there and it's entrenched, Uber is betting that if you just pull out of one of these massive cities, like if you pull out of London, it's just so catastrophic for people that have gotten used to turning to their smartphones and ordering an Uber instead of an old, you know, jolly cab. There's going to be such a backlash with city councils that people are going to get their back. But this is certainly going to force them to have to go back to cities, and they've lost a lot of clout in this judgment. I mean, this is kind of like a continental Supreme Court casting down a decision, and it's very hard for them to eclipse or supersede what that court said.
And those poor London cab drivers, by the way, who have to spend years learning the maps of London and figuring out where every single street is so that when somebody says, I want to go to this street, that they will take them there. The Uber drivers just plug it into their GPS.
Well, those guys are going to have to innovate or die as well. And you've seen it like in New York City. The cab services there now have their own ride-sharing app, even though, you know, it's like kind of a rose by any other name. A $70 fare from LaGuardia is still a $70 fare. I mean, if you put lipstick on that pig right, and have GPS capability, it's still a $70 fare. And I think that's where this question ultimately boils down to. Is Uber going to be able to cut these guys at a discount level if it's smacked with so many regulations and restrictions?
That's Robin Farzad, host of Full Disclosure on NPR One. Robin, thanks.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Did you get your flu shot? Well, if one had been available back in 1918, it might not have made much of a difference. 100 years ago in January, the worst infectious disease event in recorded history began its lethal march across the world. Historians believe the flu outbreak killed somewhere between 50 and 100 million people. John Barry is author of the 2004 book, The Great Influenza, The Story of the Deadliest Pandemic in History. He also takes a new look at that deadly year in a recent article in Smithsonian Magazine. John, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
The statistics on this are unbelievable. 14% of the population of Fiji died in 16 days. In Philadelphia, 12,000 dead in the course of 6 weeks. Take us back to what the world was dealing with a century ago.
Well, you had a lethal new influenza virus that entered the population. No one is sure exactly where. It may have been in southwestern Kansas. It could have been Indonesia. There could have been France. There are several theories. Worldwide, the death toll was between 50 and 100 million, obviously a huge range. If you adjust for population today, that would equal 200 to 450 million.
It must have caused complete chaos. I mean, what was life like for people at that time?
We were in the middle of the war, and I think that very definitely contributed to the chaos. I don't think it had much impact on the actual spread of disease. But in terms of how society dealt with it, yes, I think it had quite a bit to do with the chaos, chiefly because everyone in authority, from the Surgeon General of the United States to your local mayor, lied. Everyone could see that this was a lethal pandemic. Some of the symptoms were horrific, bleeding not only from your nose and mouth but from your eyes and ears. And yet the authorities were saying this is just ordinary influenza. If proper precautions are taken, you have nothing to fear. But people knew they had something to fear. You know, their neighbors or spouses were dying sometimes in 24 hours.
So why were health officials taking that stance?
Well, that's, of course, because of the war. And the idea was you don't say anything that might be bad news and hurt morale. This is exactly the wrong thing to do. I think ultimately society is based on trust. And once you breach that trust, then people become alienated, particularly from authority. And the worse things get, the more you feel it's everybody out for himself or herself. I mean, in most disasters, people rise to the occasion, help each other out. In this disaster, there were people starving to death both in places like Philadelphia and in rural communities in Kentucky because others were afraid to bring them food.
Right. I'm wondering what happened to the fabric of society at that time. In modern disasters, the floods, the hurricanes, the earthquakes that I've witnessed from afar, you know, in my experience, you see people coming together, helping out their neighbors. But in 1918, you hinted at this idea that it wasn't like that.
No, not at all. I mean, there was a sober, serious scientist named Victor Vaughn, who had been dean of the University of Michigan Medical School before the war and was head of communicable diseases for the Army, who said at one point, if the present rate of acceleration of the disease continues for a few more weeks, civilization could easily disappear from the face of the earth. That's how bad it was. And it wasn't just in the United States like that. In Philadelphia, there was a doctor who drove 12 miles home from his hospital every night, and there were so few cars on the road, he started counting them. And one night in 12 miles in one of the biggest cities in the country, there was not a single other car on the road. Mm. He said the life of the city has almost stopped. But in Wellington, New Zealand, at exactly the same time, another doctor stepped outside of his emergency hospital and saw nothing on the street whatsoever in the middle of the afternoon and said, it's a city of the dead. And that was the fear that drove everyone inside. And again, it was not just fear, but the lies that they were being told. You know, I was part of the process that produced recommendations for what are called non-pharmaceutical interventions in the event of another serious pandemic. You know, this effort started in the United States really in 2004 when so-called bird flu surfaced, a potentially lethal virus. And, you know, one of the things that I kept preaching and has, I think, been pretty much incorporated into every plan that I know of is that you tell the truth.
The question is, I mean, it's the obvious question, just sort of hanging in the air there like a droplet of flu virus, is not only will this happen again, but when will this happen again? And what will it be like in the United States and around the world when it does?
Well, of course, there have been an unlimited number of pandemics, and we know about a dozen or so in the last 300 years, and it will keep happening. It's the nature of the virus. In 2009, we had a mild one, the mildest on record, but there were probably in history many events like 2009 that nobody noticed because they weren't lethal. Now our molecular biology and surveillance alerts us even to the mild ones. Sooner or later, there will likely be another very dangerous virus. I think the only real answer is to develop a vaccine that will work against all influenza viruses. And the science suggests that that is possible. There is work being done on it. I think more resources need go to that exercise. I think if influenza had been taken seriously over the past decades, there's a good chance we'd have such a vaccine today.
Well, let's talk more about that vaccine, John, because I'm sure a lot of people are wondering whether or not a flu shot will stop a pandemic. Isn't that part of the problem, though, is that a pandemic is a new mutated virus that we're not prepared for?
That's correct. I mean, the virus mutates. One of the fastest mutating viruses in existence, and it changes from year to year. That's why you can get sick 2 years in a row. That's why you need a new shot, a new vaccine inoculation every year. That's why the vaccine sometimes misses the target. But a pandemic virus is one that's entirely new or has some entirely new features as opposed to simply changing from the past. And when that enters the population, there are a lot more people who are vulnerable to it.
And how will we know that it's coming? I'm reading the news this year that, for instance, Australia had a really bad flu season. Their vaccine didn't work very well at all.
Right.
Early signs that this flu season in the United States will be a tough one. What will the first wave of the next pandemic look like, and will we know it's coming?
Well, we'll know it's coming because we do monitor that stuff. There's a lot of surveillance. We won't know until it starts moving through the human population just how lethal it's going to be. As I said, 2009 was milder than a normal flu season. But there are probably many events we didn't know about just like that. So just because it's a new pandemic virus doesn't automatically mean it's deadly. However, you know, it could be. And we have no way of knowing until it arrives.
Hmm. So in that case, what does 1918 have to teach us today as we prepare for this next one?
Number one, if you want society to continue to function, I think you need to tell the truth. I think number two, or maybe this is the most important lesson, is to take the disease seriously and put some resources into finding a universal vaccine. There are measures you can take that, you know, which would work for any infectious disease or seasonal influenza that could do some good, but they're not going to do tremendous amount of good. For example, washing your hands. As simple as that sounds, that helps you protect you. The so-called non-pharmaceutical interventions I mentioned a few minutes ago are pretty much self-explanatory. They generally refer to social distancing. I mean, that's a self-explanatory part.
Like not coming to work when you're sick.
Absolutely. Basically, keeping yourself away from other people. But since this has to be sustained over a period of weeks, you know, it's not feasible to just lock yourself in a closet. Even in a lethal pandemic, that's not going to work very well.
All right. You've given us a lot to think about in a time of year when, you know, people are sneezing and coughing all around us. So that's historian John Barry. We'll link you to his recent Smithsonian Magazine piece about the 1918 flu pandemic at hereandnow.org. John, thanks very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
In the midst of all the parties and presents that come with the holiday season, many people struggle with how to help people who are less fortunate. It's thought that about a third of all charitable giving happens in the last 3 months of the year. But how do you handle that person who's panhandling at the intersection or the homeless people that you see regularly? Should you give them money or does that just perpetuate some of their problems? Amy Costello covers philanthropy and nonprofits on her podcast Tiny Spark and delves into the debate.
Anthony Ruffin says these days it's easy to feel grateful.
We know we're fortunate to be in a car, to be walking to a job, to have clothes on our backs, and we're not living in a tent. We're thankful that we have kids and our kids are going to college. We're very thankful for that.
Ruffin is a case manager working with the chronically homeless on Skid Row, an area of downtown Los Angeles that contains one of the largest populations of homeless people in the country, thousands of them. Ruffin says people in L.A. tend to be generous.
And they just give from their hearts all the time to homeless people. And I think that's a beautiful thing. I just think that's just our kindness for each other.
During his 18 years working with the homeless, Ruffin has seen many of them put money they get from strangers to good use.
I've seen people eat with the money. I've seen people go buy jackets with the money. I see people go buy a tent with the money. That's why I give, because I've seen it personally, what happens with that money.
Ruffin acknowledges that our contributions can be used to buy alcohol and other drugs. Many would-be donors are concerned about that. Substance abuse is much higher among the homeless than the general population. So what if our spare change is fueling someone's addiction?
We've lost people through overdoses for whom most of their income has come via the public.
Jeremy Swain leads Thamesreach, London's biggest homeless charity.
We put out sometimes this very stark message, which is that your kindness can kill, which absolutely isn't the same as saying to the public, please do give money to people who have been homeless, but do it at the right time, at the right point, and in a way that can help people make progress away from homelessness rather than them keeping them trapped on the streets and at risk.
Swain says our holiday-fueled generosity makes this time of year especially hard for him and his staff, who are trying to help addicts in their recovery from drugs and alcohol.
We get through Christmas with a sense of immense relief if coming out the other end, we've got everybody through safely. But sometimes we feel like we're rowing hard against the onrushing waves of public kindness, rather than feeling that people we're working with are catching those waves and are being drawn on to a better life.
When I was on the streets homeless and I was addicted to drugs, the people that gave me money saved my life, even though I went and used drugs.
Mark Horvath is a former television producer who wound up homeless. He says he lived in shelters for 7 years in Los Angeles.
If I didn't use drugs, I would have got dope sick. And if I got dope sick, I'd be vulnerable. And if I'm vulnerable, I could be mugged. And I might not even be here talking to you today.
Horvath says he's been sober for 22 years now, and he's the founder of Invisible People, a Los Angeles nonprofit that produces videos of homeless people as a way to shatter stereotypes and shift our perceptions about the problem. Horvath says we shouldn't worry too much about what desperate people are going to do with our spare change. Sure, maybe they'll use it to numb their pain, but...
If you're going to the bathroom behind a McDonald's dumpster, life sucks. Might as well have a beer. And I'm not advocating for drinking and using. I'm just trying to put it in perspective. The soccer mom's hitting the bottle. The lawyer's hitting the pipe. The postman's taking a few pills to get through the day. You know, your brother-in-law's drinking a case of beer every day. That's okay. But the guy or the girl going to the bathroom outside, I'm just saying put it in perspective. And yes, if somebody is in desperate need of money, yeah, you're helping them by giving them money.
Even though the advocates we spoke to may disagree on whether you should give cash to folks you see on the street, all of them agree that there are ways you can have more impact. Here's Los Angeles caseworker Anthony Ruffin again.
If you feel compelled to give to a nonprofit organization that works with homeless people, volunteer. You can give a lot of different ways. Check out the nonprofit organizations in your neighborhood or close to you and see what they're doing. See what they're doing and see what they're trying to do. They're doing something that you like, give to them.
And there's a good chance those nonprofits are more stretched than ever. This month, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development reported that the number of homeless people in America is growing for the first time since 2010. For Here and Now, I'm Amy Costello.
And a reminder, you can always find us on Facebook and on Twitter at Here and Now. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.